Welcome to We Are Liverpool. It's LFC's official podcast, and it's a place where you'll hear me, Peter McDowell, and Robbie Fowler talking to current and former players about their football stories and their lives off the pitch. Today's episode is with Riley Foster. She's a goalkeeper who signed for our women's team back in 2020, and as you'll discover, it really was a dream moment for her. But a year ago, a serious car accident meant her goals in life changed drastically. We should let you know here as well that you are going to hear some distressing accounts of what happened to Riley and the mental and physical toll it took on her during her recovery. But you'll also get an idea of how she was able to come through the dark times and focus on her future. You can catch up on all of our episodes on Apple, Spotify and YouTube or wherever else you get your podcasts. And be sure to give us a follow so you don't miss any new ones when they drop. Here's what to expect in today's show.
If I would have continued on longer, a little movement, a little sneeze, I could have become paralyzed. I was found 30 meters away from the car. At what point do you do the math and go, how far did you fly? I wasn't worried about playing football again. Quite honestly, I was just more happy to be alive.
We'll hear from Riley shortly, but before we do, a short message here to tell you about our LFC Store app. It's available to download on Apple and Android now and gives users lots of exclusive discounts and offers on official LFC products. Right now, here's what happened when Riley Foster joined us on We Are Liverpool.
Riley Foster, welcome to our podcast.
Thanks. How are you guys doing?
Really good. You okay?
Yeah, I'm all right.
Yeah. First goalie we've had on. Look behind you as well. We've got the Sabutio goalkeeper ready.
Oh, it looks like me.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had a little ponytail to that, and it's me.
You're probably too young for Sabutio, though.
No. See, the national team, we use it all the time for like our tactical stuff.
Yeah.
Bev Priestman loves him.
Really?
Yeah.
Brilliant. Not them little counters we use Sabutio players.
Yeah.
That could be the way forward. I quite like that.
It's crazy. I was in the LFC shop the other day, and I was like, oh, Dad, look, they have a LFC branded one. Yeah. And he was like, I've had all of them as a kid, and you collect all the little characters. But, yeah.
But you said your dad's building a bar in his house, so yeah. Maybe the Sabutio team's the next
purchase.
Yeah, I
might
purchase.
Do that and a couple of lights. Yeah. Might just take the whole set, honestly.
Yeah, it's expensive, this.
Oh, yeah, I won't tell them.
Can't
that.
Pay Robbie this week.
No. Right, thanks for coming.
Riley, it's great to see you.
Yeah.
People will detect from your accent, those who aren't overly familiar with the Liverpool women's team, that you're not from this part of the world, but you've got strong links, haven't you, with Liverpool?
Yeah, I've been kind of investigating it a lot lately since my dad was here this week, but grandparents from Wavertree, dad born and raised a Red, everything about my life has been Liverpool since I was probably able to know that Liverpool was the only thing on earth. Like, that's how it was. My whole bedspread was LFC branded, my whole room was LFC branded, grandparents kind of treated me like the golden child and kind of fulfilling their dreams.
You mentioned your grandparents there, the link with Liverpool. Tattoos are a big part of your life as well. I think when you first signed for Liverpool, that played a big part in the opening video. You've got tattoos dedicated to Liverpool.
It was kind of funny because when everyone realized I had the LFC, You'll Never Walk Alone tattoo, it was more of a, does she get that because she signed here? But no, my grandma passed away, and I believe it was 2014. And that was what I got in commemoration of her. It was the idea of, yeah, You'll Never Walk Alone. She was always with me. The whole connection to the club, but also how powerful the song is. Like every time I hear it, even in my moments now, it's very, very empowering and kind of sits with me and gives me goosebumps. So I have that tattooed in my inner bicep and always remember the connections, but also the people who are behind me and follow me along this journey.
Tattoos that have, new additions, aren't there, the injury, which we'll go into a little bit later on. Is that all part of the reminder that,
yeah,
you know, life can be tough sometimes?
Yeah, I think everyone has their own little ways of reminding themselves of their journey or none at all. But for me, horrible memory, you know, I have terrible memory. So I thought, well, put it permanently in my body and I won't forget. I can see it all the time. But no, it's some pieces of my story from as a kid to now I want to have with me all along the journey. Whether I'm playing football, whether I'm a parent, whatever it may be, just little reminders to keep me in check and keep me humble and honest of where I came from and where I began.
Probably a good segue to ask you about the title of this podcast, and we ask everybody that's on. So what is it? What is your Liverpool?
I'd say the people. Growing up, I've always known about humble beginnings. My grandparents, they worked hard for everything they had, and that was my kind of mindset of what a Scouser was. My grandparents brought my whole dad's side of the family up and kind of came back from the war and started a whole new life in Canada. But their mindset to kind of keep pushing forward, never say die attitude was ingrained in me. And when I came over here, that was exactly what I felt. It was very humble beginnings. The fan base is absolutely insane here. It's welcoming, it's warm, and they're so passionate. I've never experienced anything like that, and I've been fortunate to experience football and just life all around the globe. So that would probably be my biggest thing, but also the idea of the football. It's different here. It's the religion. I've always been growing up thinking that football is a religion, and I definitely feel that in Liverpool. Come from the players, the staff, the club. It's very prideful, and I think that's what it means to me.
How did you get into football?
My childhood, I was not like your calm kid, and it might surprise you. Not at all. But I was very energetic, and I had a lot of energy to burn, and my parents had two younger kids. We were under three, so wow. They had their hands full. So the easiest way to burn my energy and keep me in control was to give me to someone else and let them control me. So put me on a pitch, let me run around, tire me out for a couple hours, and I was quiet at home. So that's how I got into it. When it got into the more competitive level, it was more so my dad was the coach, and I just loved having a ball at my feet and on my head. It sounds funny to say that, but dad was sitting on the steps in the front porch, and he was chucking balls at my head, and I was practicing my headers and bringing it down with my chest, and that's how I became equipped to just love the game and love that kind of part of it. And then I got dead competitive and just took off from there.
I mean, I love that part, but the fact is that you're saying you love the ball at the feet and you love heading the ball. How did you become a goalkeeper then?
Yeah, so I think the idea of loving heading a ball is a bit crazy, right? And there's that element of being a keeper that's twisted. You look at what we do and you go, why? Like, why do you do that? And even now to this day, watching the girls train, I'm like, why am I doing this? But yeah, I just love the thrill, love the pressure. And I was dying like every day, Dad, can I go on goal? Can I go on goal? And he was like, no. Like, I'm not having that kid in my family, no. And eventually he just let me have it at it. And that was kind of the moment. One of my teammates' dad was a scout for one of the MLS teams in our area. And he was like, unfortunately, Dave, you got a heap on your hands. And I kind of just went at it after that. And they invested in some training and skyrocketed.
Lots of parents will have an identification with that. At every stage of the kid's life, they want to be a goalie for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's always the parents that resist it, isn't it? They want my kid to be a goalie.
Yeah, I think you do have spells, don't you? You pull out one save and you think, oh, yeah, I'm going to be a keeper. Yeah. I've been there, but I think I was better at scoring goals, mate. So.
Yeah, see, my dad made me play every position before he actually allowed me to be in goal. He's like, I'm not having the keeper that doesn't know what they're talking about, because as you can tell, I'm a vocal person. So he's like, if you're going to be in goal, you got to chat the right stuff. And learned every position before I went into goal. And once I was equipped with all that knowledge, he was like, all right, you're ready.
Going from Canada to America, how old were you then when that happened?
I went to America when I was 16, 17. And at that time, I just came off of World Cup prep with the U-20s and the U-17s. So I was just kind of never home. I don't remember much about high school at all. I know I did everything away from school. Everything was online. I lived in hotels the majority of my high school career. And after that, packed up, went to school, and kicked on from there.
So when did Liverpool become a reality then? Did you get a sniff that perhaps that might be realistic for you to come to England and play professionally?
I knew my goal. So when I was 12 years old, I sat on the countertop, my mum and dad on either side of me, and they go, okay, well, we're moving clubs, so what are your goals? Like, what do you want to achieve? And I listed off a bunch. I said, well, I want to go to a World Cup, play for Canada, I want to go to the Olympics, and I want to play professional. And they said, oh, where do you want to play? I said, I'm going to play for Liverpool. But in my head, I always thought like that would be my greatest achievement in football, like ending my career at the club of my dreams, or like that pivotal moment in your career. But I didn't think it was possible to happen as my first contract as a professional player. So when it came down to my final game in college, immediately I started the agency process. And when my now agent kind of said, where do you want to play? I said, well, I listed a bunch of players or a bunch of teams in the UWSL. And I thought, okay, this is where I think I have a good spot. This is where my style of goalkeeping will fit in. He goes, not Liverpool. I said, oh, I don't think I'm good enough. I don't think I'm ready for that yet. I need a couple years in my belt. And he goes, okay, well, let me just see what they think. And a couple days later, next thing you know, I'm in contract conversations, and it took off from there.
Was that just off a DVD then? They just seen footage?
Yeah, they
seen
my highlights. And I was fortunate at the time, the national team coach for Canada, well, at the time she was actually playing for England, Deb Priestman, was there, and her wife was on staff with the Liverpool team, so they actually knew who I was and what I was about. So I had a connection there, and I think that kind of helps when they know who you are as a person, not just a player. Like, the film can speak for itself, But I think as a person, that's really what is important in this club. And I fit in and helped out when I can and worked out.
It's all very well and good having a dream, isn't it? But when you sign your name on the contract, you get a squad number, your name on the back of the shirt, that must have been an unbelievable moment, that.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you look back on it now and you go, like, that actually happened. Like, you dream about it as a kid, and it sounds very cliche to say, oh, I dreamt about this, but I really did. Like, every time I get my own kit back home, and it was a Liverpool shirt, I was so prideful of it. I wore it with pride. I used to wear it as my goalkeeper jersey in games because I, like, hated the long sleeves. So I'd always wear the black kit. At the time, we were sponsored by Adidas, and I just felt so powerful. I had Pepe Reina's number and name on the back of my shirt. Like, it was the thing. So when it was my name, and I was in the locker room at Anfield, it was, like, I can't even really put to words that feeling, being a fan all my life and knowing that I'm kind of doing my family proud. I know my grandparents would be over the moon if they could see this happen. And yeah, it was very emotional, to say the least. And my mom was there, and just seeing everything kind of come full circle was amazing.
Right. You know, when you're talking about obviously coming to the club and obviously you're talking about putting the shirt on, how was it when you got the actual contract from you sign it and you come over and you see an Anfield for the, was it the first time?
Yeah, first time for everything. Like, my first actual contract and first time at Anfield. It was moving. I think there was a moment there where I felt like, oh, I can do this. Like, I've always wanted to be the best in the world, and I thought, I'm in the best club in the world. So to be the best, you got to be with the best. And that was my mindset. So I felt like it was a motivational factor. Like, I got my contract, but now I got to go to the work. I got to get into the training pitch. And I was on the training pitch the very next day, and I showed up, and it was just one of those motivating factors that I got to keep my shirt. And I always hear about professional sports where if you're not performing on the training pitch, or you're not performing on the game pitch, you're not really, you could lose your spot. So I kind of put that on my shoulders, and I thought, like, I need to be here. I'm the international, the only international really besides the UK citizens, and I need to really push forward with this.
You know, when you go and get served in a coffee shop and they might ask you what you do for a living, or anywhere where they don't know who you are, what are people's reactions like?
So I was always told when I first came here, like, oh, don't tell them who you are. Just, like, keep it simple, say you're a student. But I was like, no, like, this is what I've worked hard all my life to be where I am today. Like, this is my job, this is what I want to do. So when I say, like, oh, I play for Liverpool, I kind of say it like, oh, yeah. And they look at me like, really? I'm like, yeah, you don't sound like you're from here. International, from Canada. But everyone's dead, like, happy, and they're so, I think there's the idea of connecting with the fans, and a lot of people in the city centre are Scousers, and a lot of them are Liverpool fans, so that makes it a little bit easier too. But they're just so honoured, and, like, they feel privileged. And I think my whole outlook on this position that I'm in is to bring happiness to the people. And, like, the other day I was flying home from Dublin, I saw a little group of girls, and they're, like, coming over to watch our game, but I had no idea. I thought, you know, I'm going to say who I am because I know that I'll change their lives. So I kind of go with that approach in town, and it does help, and it does work, and everyone's always so happy and warm and just excited.
Okay, so you're on the plane with people flying from Dublin who were coming over to the game.
Yeah, yesterday it was like 7 a.m.
I mean, that shows you how developed the game is now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was exciting.
Like, there's nothing like, presumably, the look on the face and reflection then when you look back and you're saying you're changing their lives.
Yeah.
They realise then they're stood next to a real life female professional footballer. Yeah. I could be one of them one day.
Yeah, I think, like, for me, I never had that growing up. I looked up to the players, the men's players. Like, one of my favourite players was Jamie Carragher, sorry. All the CBG. But, like, that's what I looked up to growing up, right?
Keep going.
Yeah.
I'll get there eventually.
Yeah, you know? But, like, that's who I was. Like, Pepe Reina is, like, I never had the females to look up to. Like, it wasn't like I saw anyone in the airport going, oh my gosh, look who it is. So for me, I wanted to make sure that those girls had an everlasting impression on what they could be and how it can be for them. So it was really exciting to be able to give them that opportunity of a personal interaction that's not rushed. And I was sitting on the plane afterwards and just looking around. I was like, wow, like, I never had that. And I can just imagine, you can hear them talking about it, and they're all so excited, wanting to take more pictures. And I thought, oh, what a moment for them.
I just think it's brilliant how quickly the women's game has moved on. It probably does. I mean, obviously, you playing in America, it was very different. Yeah. It was aspirational that you can have a professional career, but it wasn't that long ago that it seemed unrealistic for young girls to think that this could be my job full time and actually get paid for it.
Yeah, when I was young and I set those goals out with my dad and my mom beside me, it was like, okay, like, we'll see. But everyone used to ask me, like, what are you going to be when you're older? And I was always the kid that everyone thought was going to be some scholar. And don't get me wrong, I'm quite intelligent, but I wanted nothing to do with the school program. I wanted to go play football, and that's all I wanted, and it's all I cared about. So the looks in people's faces were like, oh, you're a female? Like, you crazy? Like, there's no league here. So no, I'm going to play in England. Like, okay, all right, like, whatever you say, boss. And that was kind of the reactions I got. And when it happened, everyone now says, oh, I knew it was going to be you. Like, you were that kid. But in my head, I thought, oh, you all doubted it. I think a lot of females experience that at this level. It's no one really thought anyone could be professional. We see the guys do it, and that's who we look up to, but it's never an easy pathway.
The way you're describing your, obviously, upbringing, your entry into the to the football world is because you love the game. And forgive me if I'm wrong here, but it's never been about the money. It's been about the love of football and, you know, the ambition from when you were, you know, young kid. And
yeah.
I mean, the fact that she's saying that, you know, I want to be a professional, mm-hmm. when you knew that there was no longevity really, yeah. that was sticking out into you, and I loved that.
There's, let's be real here, to be able to do what we do, we perform the same level the men's do, like everything's all the same, but there is no financial gain significantly. So your only motivational factor really is the love of the game. And you got to be committed and driven to sacrifice everything as a female to play at this level. Obviously now contracts are becoming more luxurious. It's becoming more paid, more opportunity for us, but when I started, and that was not that long ago, only 3 years ago, that wasn't the case. It was, you're just playing because you love the game. And I think that's what's great about the female generation coming through, is that it's just, everyone just wants to ball their feet.
Do you see yourself as a role model for the future generations of maybe young Canadian girls who want to play football?
100%. What I always try to do is influence the next generation. I actually just put a post on Instagram the other day. It's not for me. Nothing here that I do is really for me. I do it for those who are behind me, the ones coming forward, who can see what it could be for them. I never had that opportunity, like I've said. So to give that opportunity for someone else and to show the next generation where we're going, to leave an impression and a lasting mark that'll change the game for those young females' lives is what's most important. But not only the females, the males too. Because yeah. I think we do a good job at structuring professional sport and showing what the truth and reality is and speaking up because we have that platform. It's a little bit easier for us. So to give the men an idea too of what it can be and the freedom that they're allowed to have as professional, I think is super important. So yeah, role model, lasting impression, whatever it has to be for them.
Every year, the crowds are getting more. So there is a potential for the game to go even bigger.
Yeah.
And that's the way we will see with football. You know, you see more and more on the television. I mean, the game's alive all the time now. And the standard's very, very good, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Like, that's what's so exciting is that there is a want and a craving to watch the game. At the end of the day, people just want to watch football. Mm. Whether it's male or female on the pitch, like, it doesn't matter. People just want to watch football. So you provide it. You give them the opportunities. They're going to watch. They're going to come. So that opportunity creates more hunger and more desire to come watch us play. You have to go to Prenton Park and watch us play against some of the top players in the world. It doesn't matter. It's football.
Yeah, no, I like that. Because I mean, not long ago, I done an interview with Joel, who runs the Liverpool Women's Supporter Club.
Yeah.
I mean, she's instrumental in getting buses and going to do away journeys. And I mean, you're talking this, 5-10 years ago, that was unheard of. And all of a sudden, Joel has started this supporter club and like to start and sing songs on the bus, going to games and... I mean, the experience is probably what, you know, don't take offence, but it's probably what we've seen years ago from a male point of view. But now it's getting into the female side of it. And
the songs are brilliant. Some of the songs are better than the established men's team songs.
Yeah, I mean, they're creative. I was listening to some of them yesterday and I was like, that's a new one. Wow, where'd you hear that one from? And then I'll be driving or even just in the city center and you hear a song come up and I'm like, oh, that's where they got that from. Interesting. Yeah. But no, Joe's been... essential, and I think what she's done for the game and for the fan groups is absolutely amazing because, like you said, that's something that you see in the men's side for years to come. But for the female side, you wouldn't see people easily being able to travel down to watch us play against like Arsenals or the Brightons and stuff like that. The fact that they're creating a bus, and I believe it's AXA and Expedia working hand in hand together to provide that opportunity is amazing.
We talked a lot about change during this, Riley. I can remember distinctly as doing a game, Liverpool against Aston Villa, just over a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Riley Foster gets a chance in goal, penalty hero on the day.
Yeah.
And life changes so quickly, a matter of days after that happened. Can you talk us through your memory of walking off the pitch then as a hero, which doesn't often happen for a goalkeeper, does it?
No.
And then within a matter of a week.
Yeah, it's, like you said, life changes in the blink of an eye. The Villa game for me was a pivotal moment in my career. It was an opportunity for me to kind of put my foot in and keep it there. And I took advantage of the opportunity I had, and I played out of my mind. And just the whole game itself, let alone the penalty save, like, yes, that was a highlight, but how I felt in that match, I felt powerful. I felt in control. It's the first game where I kind of felt confident in a long time, and I've gone through a lot with this club. The club itself has gone through a lot. So for me to have that feeling coming in, like, I felt good. And I remember calling my parents afterwards, and just, like, it was really emotional, you know? Like, we worked so hard for that, and I treated myself to a little holiday. And like I said, life changed at the blink of an eye.
What happened?
I went to Finland, and I went to go visit a friend of mine, and we were going to go see Drake in concert. And on the way to go see Drake in concert, it was about an hour drive. We got in a car accident. It was a single vehicle accident. Weather was a factor and other elements. And yeah, car accident happened. And next thing you know, I'm in hospital with a broken neck and good amount of other injuries.
Do you remember everything about the accident, or is it like to try and block it out?
I wouldn't say I block anything out. I've been very honest and transparent with this whole process, and I think it's not only for myself, but for the people who are going through things in life as well. In regards to the accident, I remember the accident beginning, the motions. Like, when I spin nowadays, let's say I have to do, like, circles or, like, I don't know, I spin for some reason. I vividly remember the car spinning, and that's a weird feeling. I remember hearing things.
Was it slow motion?
The car spinning was slow motion. Like, I feel like it's such a weird thing how the brain works, is it really does protect you from trauma. So I remember the spinning slow motion, but I remember looking to my friend and I thought, like, I don't want to swear on this, but I was like, oh, shit, this is happening. And after that, it's black. But then I remember being in the ambulance, and I don't remember it personally looking up at the lights in the ambulance, but I remember seeing myself from an outsider's point of view. Which is really crazy. Just recently told my family about that, because obviously it's very emotional to say, but yeah, I was looking at myself getting treatment done, watching myself in pain, watching myself cry. And I wouldn't say it's an out-of-body experience because I was dead, because I was clearly alive on the table, but it was weird how I was just completely disassociated. I felt like I was in Grey's Anatomy and everything around me was going on. I'm just watching it happen to me.
How do you process that now then? What do you think that was? You say it's not an out-of-body experience. What do you think it was?
I don't know. I can't put words to it. Like, I'm still trying to figure that out myself. It was really hard to kind of speak about to my family at first, because obviously I'm more worried about them, what they think. But I know it wasn't an out-of-body experience because I was dead. I think it's, again, one of those things where your body's protecting yourself, your mind's protecting yourself, and sometimes you disassociate yourself from the situation. And I kind of like to say that's what happened to me. I disassociated myself completely. Medication was also involved in those moments. I was given 4 doses of fentanyl right away. So maybe it was hallucinations. Who knows?
Dominic Matthews said the same thing when he had his treatment, that he felt as though he was looking down, and he had the decision to make then whether to carry on or give up. And he had a young boy, 2 teenage girls, and he thought, I can't, it's not time for me yet.
I remember being in and out in the hospital, but not like, I feel like it's just consciousness. Like, well, I had a brain injury, so no wonder I'm in and out. But I remember watching them cut my clothes off me, and attaching all, like, this, my little buttons and my heart stuff and everything, and attach me to oxygen. And I just remember looking at myself going, like, is this it? The only concerns where I had a lot of pressure on my arteries in my neck, and the blood flow to my brain and my cervical spine area was compromised, but nothing where I was actually, like, needed to be revived or anything. When I was found in the field, the paramedics found me sitting upright screaming, so I was awake. The fact that I was sitting upright is bizarre, but yeah, apparently in the ambulance there was a bit of a struggle, but it wasn't like I wasn't, it was just because I couldn't breathe, and it was from the seatbelt damage to my lungs and stuff. I remember feeling vulnerable in a way of no control. Like, I'm having everyone do things for me.
Which you weren't used to.
Never. I'm not a vulnerable person. I'm very, like, in control of myself, very independent. So for this moment, watching myself be literally as vulnerable as can be, it was very scary. I remember waking up the next day just wondering what has happened to me and why am I here? And you start to ask, why is this happening to me? So I remember watching that going, I'm making a story out of this. Like, I remember thinking that going, this isn't my identity, but I'm going to make it something of me. Mm. And I actually recorded a video on Snapchat. It came to up my memories the other day. And I was speaking to myself, but speaking to the public at the same time, saying, I'm coming back. Whoever listens to this, this is my moment. I'm not going to let it define me. It was weird.
How do you comprehend being in a field when you've been in a car?
So I think the idea of being ejected from a car, you only see in movies, and it's, you don't really think about it happening to yourself or anyone. You would never wish that upon anyone, and you think instantly that's death. So the fact that I was ejected from a car, going at who knows what the speeds were, because once you hit ice and stuff, you accelerate even more, and we're airborne, and I flew. It's almost as if, like, considering my injuries, considering how that happened, it's weird. Like, you should die from impact. You should die from anything. You see the pictures of the car. No one should survive that. It's like people picked me up and just bloop, plowed me down, and now I'm safe in circumstances, safe as can be. But yeah, it's hard to wrap my mind around. I remember thinking, like, how do you? The accident duration was 400 meters. I was found 30 meters away from the car. At what point do you do the math and go, how far did you fly? It's really hard to wrap your mind around.
Did you ever find out from the paramedics, because presumably they turn up at that scene, they see the car, that they're probably not expecting to find anybody still alive, are they?
Yeah, I was told by the doctors that it was a miracle, to say the least. I've actually been on this mission to find the paramedics who treated me in the field, because I owe them a lot. They were the first responders and essentially could have saved my life. But yeah, I was in the worst conditions possible. Everyone else who was in the car was responsive and alert, whereas I was responsive but not alert. So yeah, it was one of those things where the doctor said, you're a living miracle. Like, the car was unidentifiable. You were unidentifiable. Like, it was bad.
What injuries are you? You spoke about your neck. What else?
So from head to toe, I had a subdural hematoma on the right side of my head and the back, and they believe that's from going out the windscreen or landing.
What is that, Riley? Just very basically, what is that?
Basically, it's pressure built up it's a blood pressure and blood between the skull and the brain. So not the actual brain being bruised, not the skull being damaged, but it's in between, which is actually very dangerous, because if it does increase, the pressure increases, it affects the brain. But I was fortunate that it was stabilized significantly quick enough. Fractured my neck in 7 pieces in my first 2 vertebrae.
7?
Yeah, so my C1 was in 4, and my C2 was in 3. Jefferson's burst fracture, so Christopher Reeves, the exact same fracture he had done, except my life turned out to be very fortunate. Unfortunately for Christopher Reeves, he struggled, and it really did affect his physicality and everything. And then going down, I did my shoulder. Just like structural damage, nothing too crazy there. My hip, and they just believe I jarred my hip landing. So it kind of affected the labrum in there. And then I tore my quad off the bone partially, and my MCL. And then I had one of the worst femoral bone bruises they've ever seen. And they don't know how my femur didn't break at the head, which is very catastrophic if you break your femur that low. And I also broke my lower back in 2 places.
She's showing off now, isn't she?
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
Yeah, all in one go. Didn't have to get any stitches, no surgery.
Just clean breaks everywhere.
Yeah, I had some glue in the bottom of my chin. That's about it. Oh, and I had a cheekbone fracture. Can't forget that one.
Oh my God, that's unbelievable. Isn't it?
Yeah. It's crazy to think about, like, all those injuries.
And the fact that you sat talking about it, mm-hmm. I mean, that's... Have you got a newfound feeling on life as well?
Yeah, 100%. Like, at first I was in a euphoric state of, I'm just so happy to be alive, so happy to be able to... At the time, you think, oh, I'm going to play again because I can move. I can move my legs, broke my neck, and I can still move my lower body. So it's really exciting, but I just become so prideful in the little things in life. Like, I never used to be someone who got homesick. I almost would go home and want to get back over here right away. But I go home and I don't want to leave. My dad came over last week and I don't want him to leave. Like, those little things in life. And even just as a person, you're in conversation with people, maybe you get in an argument. I don't want to argue with people because you never know when that's your last moment. And then I've had some family strife going through the last few months. And you just think, like, these little moments, like, it's not worth it. Like, I'm not going to hold it against you. Like, you're my people, like you're my family, and you could be gone in a second, and anyone you meet, that's how I feel. Like every opportunity I get, I take, because it could be my last. And you always say that metaphorically, and like, no one really actually thinks that, but I've experienced it when I'm living the highs of life, and all of a sudden it's nearly, like I'm talking centimeters taken away from me. You just think, whoa, what am I going to do with this second chance of life? Because I've literally been given the second chance.
Your dad gets that phone call that we all dread as dads, as little girls, been in an accident. You're in Finland at the time as well. Yeah. You probably won't remember too much about it because of all the painkillers you were on. But what does he tell you about that moment when you had to tell your sister first off, or somebody else had to tell your sister that you've been in this accident?
I had to call my cousin first because I had tried to call my parents, and obviously the time change, it was like early morning, 4 a.m. for them. And I had waited to call my family because people had asked me in the hospital, like, do you want us to call your family? I said, no, wait until I get all the information, because I know they're going to have a gazillion questions like they do after a match. So I thought, let me just wait up, hold off for them. I also wanted to become stable enough to tell them myself. I didn't want them to hear it from anyone else.
How long has passed then between the crash?
24 hours. I felt like 24 hours, could have been 12. It was like a day. I was transferred hospitals and stuff between this time, so I wanted to make sure I was in the right spot and had all the right information. But I called my cousin because no one was answering the phone at home.
Sorry, Riley, did the family know? So I know you're obviously waiting for yourself to phone the family, but they must have known beforehand that something had happened. And did someone that you were with contact them and let them know that you were in hospital, or?
Well, see, what happened was before we took journey to go to Helsinki to go see Drake in concert, I called my mom, like I always do. I let my mom know everything, and that's just a rule we have in our family. It's like, hey, I'm going into town. I don't know if I'm going to be on my phone much. We're going out to have a good time. But I love you. And her response was to my friend saying, you keep my baby safe. And he goes, oh, I will. I promise you. So they knew where I was. They knew not to hear from me because I was busy and I was having fun, but I did tell them I would let you know when I'm available. And because of the time change, it actually kind of worked hand in hand. But yeah, so my cousin found out first. I was holding my phone kind of like this, so she could only see the first half of my face, and she thought, oh, what'd you do, getting like a fight in the club? I thought, no. And I turned the thing down. It's my whole get up. I had the neck brace on, my whole face, and she just starts freaking out, crying, and like it was a mess, like bad. I said, I need you to call my family. So she did. She called my middle sister. So I have two younger sisters, and Addie answered the phone because she's getting ready for work that morning. And she goes, Addie, something's happened to Rye. You need to get your mom and dad on the phone. So Addie goes downstairs and tells my mom and dad. My dad answers. My dad talks to Lowen. My mom wakes up and goes, what's going on? And my dad goes, it's Rye. And mom starts screaming. Addie went upstairs to go tell my other sister to wake up. Mackie wakes up, and it was actually Mackie's birthday the day before, October 15th. So Mackie had that birthday party, and she was sleeping. A little hungover at this moment. And she wakes up, and Mackie hears mom crying. And goes, it's Rye, she's dead. And Addie's like, no, she's not dead. And Mackie's still waking up from sleep, she's dead, isn't she? And Addie goes, no, but it's bad. It's real bad. So, yeah, that's how my parents found out. Obviously, I didn't let them FaceTime me until my dad came here, because I wanted my dad to see me in person. I didn't want him to see me on the phone. So I protected him from that kind of stuff, and then it went on from there.
What was the treatment path from there then? You're in a foreign country, another foreign country at this stage. What did they need to do quickly?
So immediately I was told I needed surgery. And I looked at them saying, I'm still in shock. This is 24 hours in. I'm still in shock. I'm heavily medicated. There's a bunch of stuff going on here. I do not need surgery. That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm thinking about my career here. I'm thinking, no. I wanted my dad there. I knew he was coming. I said, wait until my dad comes. But I'm not getting surgery yet. If it's not that serious, I'm not dying. I'm not getting surgery. So we put that off. And then things kind of just change weirdly. And they go, oh, yeah, you're fine. Like, your neck's fine. You'll be fine in 3 months. So I'm in a C collar or an Aspen collar. And that was it. Treatment plan was just rest in a collar for 3 months. And then obviously you do rehab and you'll be back. That wasn't the case. Obviously I had other injuries that I had to heal. The pressure of the arteries in my neck, the subdural hematoma, and my lung function needed to be healed prior to flying home. But yeah, they said I was fine. And then I got to Liverpool. My imaging was given to my team doctor, Amelia. And she sent it to the Walton Center because that was the best place to be. And that's where we were going to continue my treatment for. And little did we know that I wasn't fine, and my fractures were actually coming further apart, and I was in the most vulnerable state I could be prior to the accident actually happening. And that's when I was called in for an emergency procedure to get the halo on.
Do you think as well, fortunate's the wrong word, because you won't feel fortunate at probably many stages of it, but the fact you are a professional athlete attached to one of the biggest organisations in the world, is that when you start to get that upturn where that expertise has almost discovered how serious the injuries are? Without that, and you'd have been a normal person off the street, you just wonder whether that path would have been quite as straight after that.
Yeah, I think if I was a normal person or anywhere else, they could have just taken the word from the doctors in Finland and said, you know what, yeah, that's what it is, all right, you're fine, keeping the neck brace will monitor you. Because Liverpool and our medical team decided to seek expert help, the idea was to get me back to the pitch as soon as possible, of course. Without that information, without a professional seeing and a second point of view, I don't think I'd be here talking to you guys. I don't think I'd be able to return. I think my neck and my skull would be fused together, and that's the reality of what could have happened. I think I would have been needing to have an emergency procedure, or I was told that if I would have continued on longer, or any moment of being in the neck brace, a little movement, a little sneeze, anything, I could have become paralyzed. So the fact
you were a sneeze away potentially from not being able to walk again.
Yeah, I was literally a trip, a step, like anything could have happened. And I was getting more comfortable. Obviously, you get hurt, and all of a sudden you go, oh, I can walk on my ankle now. But no, this was, I can move my neck a little bit more. So I wasn't safe, and they would have my bones never would have fused together at the rate they were at. My skull was actually pushing them further apart.
When you get that when that call or that conversation about, you know, what can happen, do you think about playing football again, or do you think I'm happy to be alive?
I wasn't worried about playing football again. Quite honestly, I was just more happy to be alive. It's weird. You go through different emotions, right? The grieving process, as they call it. And like I said, I was very happy to be alive at first. And you go through the anger, the sadness, and everything like that. And I go through like a wave of, I'm going to play again. And then it's not safe. It's not worth it. You're talking about the second chance of life and the new point of view of life. Like, I went through the ringer, quite literally. And now I have this opportunity to do something different. And I have a new platform. Football, is it really worth it? Is it really worth to put my body through more pain and more strife? Or do I want to do something different? And that was what I was struggling with for a really long time.
What are those demons like coping with? You have a lot of time on your hands there, don't you, when you're yeah. lying in a hospital bed or sat in the flat at home?
Yeah, I think.
You must have had some really dark moments.
It's hard, yeah. I would say dark is the right word. Like I said before, I'm very independent. I protect my family from the worst news possible. And at this time, my sister was taking care of me, and she was my caregiver, washing me in every aspect way and wiping my behind because I couldn't do it myself. So she was already seeing me at my most vulnerable state, and I didn't want people to really know. So I put on this brave face and just, like, my sister called it a mask, where I just kind of plowed along and took each day as it came. But reality was, I was struggling, and to this day I still am. Like, it was hard, and it is hard to kind of look back and go, oh, I survived the unheard, and now I have to play football again. And everyone around you see it on social media, so excited to see you back in goal, so excited to see you back on the pitch, so excited to see you back in the kit. And it's like, yeah, I'm so excited too, but am I? Am I really excited to have to go through it all over again? And I'm not even worried about my neck. It's the journey to get there. It's the journey to want to throw my body on the ground and hurt even more. Like, I don't want to deal with pain anymore. I've already dealt with my pain. I've dealt with my lifetime amount of pain. I don't want anything to do with that anymore. So it was like, it's really hard to wrap your mind around and find that new identity of who you are and what you are. And I think it's weird, but not everyone has that opportunity. And I'm very fortunate to have the ability to think back and go, who am I? Who am I besides a footballer? Because everyone has something else, and we all fall into faults of identifying yourself as a professional footballer, but that's not who I am. That's what I do. That's what I'm good at. That's what I'm passionate about. But there's more to Riley Foster than a footballer.
You've mentioned a few times now about being physically independent. So obviously, you leave Canada at a young age. You obviously go and play in MLS. You're coming over here. Then obviously this happens here, and people have got to work for you, basically, and they've got to try and help you to get better. How was that? Because obviously there's things that you can't do, but you're relying on them to sort of get you through, you know, certain periods and certain moments.
I hated it. I hated watching my sister have to help me into the bathtub. I hated watching my sister have to help me sit on the toilet. Hated watching my sister wash my hair. Like, I used to have to arch my back over this tub and she would scrub my hair. And it's funny. There's some funny moments, but it's not funny. Like, it was painful and it was uncomfortable. Not being able to do things that I love, like cooking. I love walking around in town. I love, like, being able to read a book. I couldn't read a book for, like, 7 months because my brain was, first of all, like, mush from the medication. But I also had a brain injury, and I had to reteach myself things of life. Obviously, I looked proficient, but there was a lot of things that I was lacking that most people don't realize. Other things, like sleeping on the couch when I was at home, and my hand would curl up because the dexterity of my hand was lost based on pressure onto my spinal cord, my nerves and stuff. And my mom would freak out because my hands were curling and I wasn't using my hands properly. And her opening them, I'm like, Mom, I'm fine. But I really wasn't. I didn't have the strength in my hand. So it was hard for me to accept that. It was hard for me to accept the help. It was hard for me to accept the medication because I've never been someone who would even take, like, naproxen for fun. Like, I really just handled all my pain on my own. So to have to medicate myself was absolutely devastating.
Seeing you sat here now, I saw you in town. I remember it like it was yesterday, seeing you in the halo. I got so upset after I'd seen you. You look so poorly. To see you now with the halo off. Even a couple of weeks ago when we had a coffee together and you were talking about the next steps in your life as opposed to your career, I get the sense that something's changed a little bit since then and you're starting to talk about footy again.
Yeah, I've said to my dad the other day that I'm going to make the comeback. There's a lot to the story that it's hard to explain why I didn't want to. Mentally, I was done. But I owe it to myself, and I've been giving back to everyone else, but this is my moment to say, like, you're going to regret this if you don't make the effort to go back. And I could call it quits right now. I really could, but what's that going to do for me? I'm going to live with regret my whole life, wondering if I could have done it. Could I have played again? So, yeah, I'm going to push myself to the furthest limit. I hope it ends up being back on the pitch. I hope it ends up with me. I mean, saying the World Cup right now is a bit ambitious, but in the Olympics the following year, like, I hope it ends up being there. Because that's truly what I want to do. And that's what I'm ready for. Like, I've hit that moment in my rehab where I'm going, you know, this is mentally I'm ready for it. And physically, I think I'm going to be the stronger version of myself in all aspects. I've been very open on social media, showing people what I'm doing. And I feel like I'm training like I'm an F1 driver or like a UFC fighter right now. Like, my neck is becoming stronger. I'm literally lifting weight and curling it with my neck. I'm going to be the strongest version of myself mentally, physically, and emotionally. So I think that only sets myself up for a really strong career.
What's the advice from the physios and you know, the club and people like that?
I think anyone who would hear my story, they and my injuries, they go, it's not worth it. Like, you've survived the unheard. Take it easy on yourself. And, you know, like, you're so smart, you can do anything else. But the physios and the doctors, I'd say the doctors in Walton Center, have said it's in my hands. Technically, my neck is as strong as it can be in a structurally point of view. I do have one lingering fracture that's not fully healed. It's now a non-fibrous union. So that's like the only questionable part. But with the muscles and the strength that I'm developing around my neck, I should be robust enough to adhere to it. And obviously, there's a lot more research, experience, and information that we have to gather before I do make this big jump. But it is in my hands, and everyone, I think, will support me no matter what.
Does that make you happy, though? The fact is that the physio, the doctors all said it's in your hands. I mean, that's a good sign, isn't it? Surely.
It is a good feeling, because there was times in my journey, and I'm sure, Peter, you've seen this, where I was told I couldn't play again. Like, I really was told it's not going to happen. So the fact that now it's pivoted to where I can play again, and they're saying, like, it's up to you, it feels good to know that my body's done the unhurt. Like, they didn't think my neck was actually going to heal. I was supposed to be in the halo for a long period of time, and then they were going to do surgery after if it didn't work. So the fact that I've done that, come through that, and now I can play, it is prideful. There are moments in this career, in this journey, that I thought it would have been easier if they could just make the decision for me. Yeah. Because you don't know what's going to happen. There's a lot of, like I said, I've had a lot of injuries, a lot of elements of the brain that I have to protect. And you don't want to put yourself at too much risk. So sometimes it's easier for them just to say it for you.
Yeah, go. Cool. What was the first thing you done when you took, when you got the halo off?
I looked down at my toes.
Seems simple, doesn't it? But you hadn't been able to do that, had you?
I couldn't move. I looked down at my toes and went, whoa. Like, I felt like I was falling off a building. The first thing I did was I actually went home. And I took the neck brace off. It sounds weird, but I laid on my bed, took the neck brace off, because I had to have tummy time, but on my back. And took it off, and it was just a feeling of being free. Called my family, and everyone was just watching me, and I tried to move my head. I couldn't move my head at this point. I couldn't even lift it off the bed. But just the idea of even thinking that I could. And then I went to Paris next week. And I celebrated with my sister. We went to Paris and we had a great time.
You're probably one of the mentally toughest people I've ever met, genuinely.
Thank you.
Honestly, I mean that.
That's unbelievable. God,
the story's unbelievable. And the fact is, if I've got a halo on and I've got on for a amount of time and, you know, what's happened to me, I mean, I'm getting a little bit emotional talking about it now. But, and then, I mean, I'd go back and I'd sob my eyes out.
Yeah, I never did. I couldn't. I physically could not cry. I couldn't feel bad for myself. I couldn't do it. Because, you know, it sounds so corny to say, but I actually think there's other people who are worse off. I have an aunt who was in a car accident and she became a quadriplegic, so paralyzed from the neck down. And I could have been that person, but I wasn't. And I thought, it's not that bad. Mm. But it was bad. It was very bad. And you're living on the verge of death. But I couldn't wrap my mind around it that much.
I just wonder whether that there might be a seismic moment, hopefully when you play again, where the tears might come then.
I think it will. I think it needs to be an emotional moment. I'm going to tell myself to be emotional if I'm not, because like thinking about me returning, it is an emotional experience. And my first time when I played against United and I had a great game, I cried after that match. I cried on the pitch. And if it's nothing but more moving than that, then I've got to go to the doctor and get my brain checked.
I wanted to ask you about the girls, Riley, because players who are injured, you know, male players from our team and generations like Robbie's, it was the last place they wanted to be when they were injured because they couldn't affect it. But that's been a consistent part of your rehab, if you like, that you want to be with the girls, you want to be around the girls at games. Yeah. Has that helped you as well? And has that changed your relationship with your teammates, do you think, over that time?
I think my teammates have seen me, like everyone else, at a very vulnerable state. And I was never that person. I'm the person who comes in smiling. I'm the person that comes in laughing. I'm the person that works so hard in the field, like a different personality in the pitch that they miss. And I think it's my lightheartedness and how hard I train. So seeing me in this vulnerable state where I was quite literally miserable, but still putting a smile on my face was very hard for them. And I didn't realize that they felt that way. And that really set, like, it touched home for me. But being around the team, it does help. It motivates me now. I would say a couple weeks ago, I hated being around the training grounds. Absolutely hated it. Watching people do what I can't do. And I still don't like it. And I think anyone who's injured feels that way. You don't want to be in the gym. You don't want to be in the treatment room. It's horrible. But I'm becoming more warm to it. I'm becoming more motivated to watch. Watching training is hard for me, but I'm getting there.
Let's try and round it up then, because it feels like there could be about 3 or 4 episodes of this podcast with Riley, because there's so many different chapters to still tell. We normally ask former players or players that have had a story to tell so far in their career, how they want to be remembered. But I'm going to change it slightly to, what is the next set of targets for you now? We've spoken about the aim to play again. Are those targets in life now because of what you've been through? Or are they football specific?
I think that's a life target. I've gone through a lot. And like I said, I owe it to myself. I want to push myself as physically possible to the furthest limit. And I think that's just for the reasons of, I've done the unheard. I'm not supposed to be walking. I'm not supposed to be talking. I should be a tetraplegic. Like all these words that the doctors throw at you. So playing again would be like my stamp and saying like, you can't beat me. Nothing's going to beat me. And that's always been my mindset as a player, saying like, beat the person in front of you and be the strongest one there. But literally, if I do this, there's nothing that can knock you down. Like I've gone through the unheard of.
Riley, it's great to see you. You look absolutely wonderful. We love you to bits. We wish you all the best with the next chapter.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. If you are listening on Apple and enjoyed it, we'd love a 5-star rating from you. It'll also highlight the podcast to those who haven't found us yet. Once again, you've not got long to wait for our 5th episode. Here's what to expect in 2 weeks' time.
When people talk about me, they say, oh, Rafa is defensive. It's not true. And I went outside, the Turkish security, no, you cannot. And Richard told them, listen, do you know who is this man? He's God. He said, he's God.
Whoa, there's only one of them, Rafa.
People say, Rafa made a mistake because he sold Alonso. But it was 3 times that I have to manage the situation the best way for Liverpool Football Club.
Remember to follow We Are Liverpool on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can watch us on YouTube as well. We'll speak to you next time.